I can't imagine what it's like to know that you are fearful of your own child, because you seem like a very close-knit family.
It's life-changing, you might say. We were terrified.
So he brings his gun. He's walking very slowly down the road. And I mean, it's eerie. Bam, 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 bam. The officer gets out and the cop has drawn his gun and tells him, turn around now, throw it down. And what Adon is doing is he turns around, he takes the gun out. That was a very scary moment.
We all knew something was wrong. We all felt something was terribly wrong.
This is Catalyst, an investigative podcast from KXAN News and Nexstar Media Group. I'm Josh Hinkle. This season, we explore mental health in Texas County jails and the severe backlog for inmates to get treatment.
It just stresses me. It makes me feel really sad. I know the impact that it has on the family, and it's a black mark on our state. It's something that we shouldn't accept as taxpayers and as citizens.
Hundreds of men and women waiting in jail, often in isolation, mentally deteriorating for years in some cases. A broken system forcing the wheels of justice to a halt.
Justice delayed is justice denied on both sides of that issue. The person that's accused is entitled to a speedy trial, but society and the victim of whatever crime is entitled to also get it tried as quickly as they can.
We take a closer look at aging and crowded state hospitals and discover new solutions outside their walls, working in some places right now, and maybe others in the near future.
It's a very compelling need. It can be heart-wrenching. It's hard to see people suffer from mental illness, but at the same time, it gives you a reason to be dedicated to your job.
To start, I want to introduce you to a mental health worker north of San Antonio.
My name is Maria Ana Esparza, and I live in Spring Branch, Texas. I'm a middle school counselor, and I've been one for, 15 years. And prior to that, I was a teacher for 20 years or so. I counsel middle school students, grades 6 through 8, as they're going through adolescence.
I sat one Saturday afternoon with Maria Esparza in her dining room. Its window overlooked the front porch, stretching all the way across her Victorian-style home. The view? A long gravel driveway lined with cedar trees. Not many neighbors this far out of town. And Maria seemed to like the quiet. Her days with middle school students could be hectic.
Yesterday, I was sitting with a sixth grader trying to help him through his meltdown that he'd had in class and giving him alternative ways to respond to frustration. And I sent him back to go get his work so we could start working on it. And then somebody came to the door and they were in tears.
Is it on?
Extreme close-up of the nose.
Yeah. There goes mom.
Beyond her kids at school, Maria raised 4 of her own. 2 girls, 2 boys.
Vanessa, Carla, Adan, and Alonso.
Her oldest son is 33.
And here's Adan.
Adan.
His name is Adan. A-D-A-N.
Adan Castaneda.
Adam in Spanish.
Okay, this is Adan, and he is going to be recording next, okay? Let's get a good look at him. Okay, here you go, Adan.
You gotta talk
and
say, this is
Ivan
Miguel
Castaneda.
I am 11 years old, and I'm now doing the recording.
Be quiet. This is Adan.
Maria smiled as she dug through home movies and old photos of Adan growing up.
He just had these dimples when he's little, so cute. I like that picture of him when he was playing baseball. Adan was just like any other kid growing up, just very energetic. like to climb trees, like to run around, like to ride bikes, loved sports. He played baseball as a kid, played football in junior high, and also basketball, did pole vaulting in high school. So he was very energetic. He also had very good grades. In 2004, he graduated from high school and he decided that he wanted to serve his country because that's around the time that the war was declared in Iraq. So he immediately after finishing high school, he joined the Marine Corps.
What did you think about that?
I didn't like it. Of course not. No, I don't think there are many moms that want their kids to go into the service, especially in a time of war, because there's always that fear that what if he doesn't come back? He was stationed in Iraq and he saw many things that people don't wish to see, and that impacted him. He was a scout sniper. It's a very difficult job to perform in the military because you're alone most of the time. You're in specific areas for long periods of time, and so the conditions under which you're having to perform your job are more difficult than most.
What was the worst thing that he saw or experienced over there?
He was told to stand down, but to be, you know, ready to kill. There were many situations where they had to storm into houses in the middle of the night to confiscate weapons. There were many situations where they had to travel at night for hours at a time without any food or liquids. And one of those times, he became so dehydrated that he had to get medical attention. He saw bombs that exploded just right in front of where he was stationed. I think he was just surrounded by a lot of death and potential for death, and so that was always on his mind. He discharged in 2008, December 2008, and had a really difficult time. When he came back, he was not the same young man that left.
How could you tell something was not right?
He slept all day and stayed in his room all the time, except to go to the bathroom, to get something to drink, sometimes get something to eat. He didn't want to go anywhere. He didn't want to do anything. He just had a really hard time focusing on anything. He'd get angry with his own self and be upset with himself, but never talked about it. Just was angry and just stayed in his room. He lay in bed and he just kind of covered his face.
He saw some doctors. What did they tell him? Did they prescribe him medicine, counseling?
You know, part of getting help is recognizing that you need help, but that's really hard when you've been told as a Marine that you've got to be independent. And so he tried to figure it out and he just couldn't. And that just made him more and more frustrated. He did go to the VA, they gave him medication. That was their solution.
Maria glanced out the window. The porch, the driveway, the house. We were sitting inside a crime scene from 9 years earlier.
Tell me about the day that the shooting incident happened here.
Around May of 2011, at about 4 a.m. And at that time of night, I couldn't go back to sleep. And I heard what I thought was, I thought it was just like grease popping, like when you put some oil in a pan. He shot 23 bullets into our home from the driveway. It was unexpected. We didn't know what was going on. And I came out and he just said, no, get down. Don't come out here.
Your husband?
Yes. And he got on the phone and called the police department.
What was Adon like at that point when all of this was happening? Did you see him? Could you hear him?
No. No, the driveway is pretty long. It was dark. He was picked up by the local sheriff's department and taken to jail. And then began the nightmare of the next few years of trying to navigate the criminal justice system.
Comal County deputies booked Adon on 7 counts, including aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and attempted murder of his own mother and stepfather. Maria says she knew her son was suffering, but never thought it would go this far. Before he showed up at their house that night, she'd tried reaching out to him, concerned with recent behavior.
His language was bizarre, just didn't make sense, and I knew that something wasn't right, and he wouldn't allow me to go see him. He was alienating himself again, isolating himself, and I knew that was one of the signs that something bad was happening.
Only hours earlier, Adon sent her a text saying, "Stop contacting me or I'll take a taxi to your house and kill you." That text was now part of the evidence stacked against him. Comal County officials declined our request for an interview, but court records provided a timeline.
He did get evaluated by a psychiatrist. He was found incompetent to stand trial.
Go ahead and roll that. I'm rolling over here.
To better understand what incompetent means in a case like this.
Whenever you guys are ready. It's
all right.
I'm good.
Okay.
We met with one of the state's leading mental health advocates.
Yeah, my name is Greg Hanch. I'm the executive director of NAMI Texas, which is the Texas affiliate of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI is a nonprofit organization that exists to help improve the quality of life for people affected by mental illness. One of the things that we do in that area is advocacy on behalf of people with mental illness and their families. And we have a serious concern about lack of access to necessary services. And so as a result of that, we speak up on these issues because we see people suffering behind bars, not getting the care that they need.
And oftentimes these people can't always speak up for themselves.
You know, many of these folks are low income, from broken homes, aren't able to get a good criminal defense attorney to sort of advocate for them in the legal system. So we're receiving calls at our office very frequently from family members. We're getting letters from individuals behind bars saying, "I'm not getting the care that I need. The services that are essential for my recovery and my well-being are not being made available to me." So we have an obligation, due to our mission to improve the quality of life, to sort of speak out and advocate on these issues.
And one of the most challenging issues in Texas is mental competency in jail.
When people are arrested and charged with a crime and booked into jail and eventually put in front of a judge, the issue of competency to stand trial can be raised. And what competency means is the ability to participate in one's own criminal defense. Some people lack that ability due to a mental illness, and as a result, because of the Sixth Amendment's constitutional guarantee of a fair trial, in order to proceed with that trial, you have to restore that person's competency. The state hospital system is the most common setting where competency restoration occurs.
If the system worked efficiently, you would go pretty quickly to a state hospital facility so you could get the treatment that you need to come back to jail and then quickly get into helping with your defense.
Absolutely right.
He was found incompetent to stand trial. And so he was remanded to North Texas State Hospital. And so I felt a great sense of relief thinking, oh, you know, finally he's going to get some help. They've recognized that he has some mental health issues and he can't participate in his own defense, so he'll get some help. And I waited a couple of weeks and nothing happened. He was still there. So I contacted the sheriff's department and said, "When are you transporting?" And they said, "You'll have to contact the hospital because it's not up to us. They're the ones who have control of him now, so it's up to them." So I contacted them, and the person who answered the phone asked me who I was and who my son was, and then she looked it up and said, "Well, it'll be 8 months to a year," and I was shocked. And I asked, "How could that be?" And she said, "We just don't have enough beds." And that's when I realized that, you know, he wasn't going to get the help that he needed, that sense of relief was false, and I just was pretty lost. I didn't know what to do.
Adon needed medication and counseling to restore his competency. there are 10 state hospitals in Texas. Only a few take maximum security inmates, and none had a bed available for Adan.
The biggest problem is that the state of Texas lacks the capacity to provide speedy competency restoration services to everyone who's in need. In fact, hundreds of people right now are waiting in county jail for access to competency restoration services.
In 2019, Texas hit a record number of inmates waiting for a state hospital bed, 1,017 in a single month. And for someone like Adan under maximum security, the average wait time had spiked at 335 days.
How did we get to the state we're in Texas, where there is such a backlog?
One of the reasons why Texas has such a significant backlog is that we have an aging state hospital system. Some of the facilities were built in the 1800s. So you have buildings that are in disrepair. You have buildings that are in remote rural parts of the state, where they're not able to attract an adequate mental health workforce. So you have beds that are offline and not available because of that. And our state is rapidly growing. Hundreds of people are moving to Texas every day. The stats show that 1 in 5 people have a mental health condition. So there's an increased demand for these services. And the supply that we have to restore competency and provide other essential services is just not enough.
Where does Texas fall into this conversation? I mean, are we worse than other states or better than others?
I think we're on the lower end of the spectrum. It seems clear that Texas, by and large, has less access to mental health care per capita than most other states do. So we definitely have some catching up to do. That said, we've received a significant amount of attention over the last few legislative sessions. $745 million in new money has been invested in the state hospital system. And that's a big deal. It's going to result in more accessible care and higher quality care. We're not necessarily going to receive the results of that investment until 5-10 years down the road. The job is not done. A significant investment is needed in the 2021 legislative session to finish the projects that have already been started. There's no sense in going part of the way and then throwing in the towel. That's inefficient.
Why should everyday Texans who may never come into contact with the criminal justice system, why should they care?
This is an issue that really kind of lives in the shadows. People are blissfully ignorant about this issue because until it affects them, you know, they're often not really going to be aware or care about it. But I think everyone should care about it. I mean, the reality of mental illness is that it can contribute to criminality. And some people are fairly high risk because of the mental health conditions that they have. We need to treat these people fairly, humanely, treat it like a public health issue, because that's what it is.
There were pictures that were taken by the police department of all the places that were impacted. He shot 23 bullets into the house, so some of them went through the door. There's some bullets that went here, up there. There were bullets that shot here, that went up over by the fireplace. One of the panes in the kitchen got broken.
I mean, I can't believe you guys weren't hit in this
whole thing. Can't believe it either. We were terrified. We left the house. We went somewhere else for a couple of weekends just to feel safe before everything got repaired. It forces you to look at options because you can't manage your life in the same way. You have to get a new level of knowledge to be able to understand what's going on and to proceed with your life in a different way, because the old way is just not going to work.
Those police pictures of the damage from that night also included a few of a framed photo hit by Adan's bullets. Behind the shattered glass, another dark-haired young man smiled back. a memory clouded by a different family tragedy. Maria had already lost one son. She was determined not to lose a Don, too. Next time.
What the heck? Where is he? There he is. That's Alonso with his starter pistol. Do not point that.
Alonso had had some friends over. They were having a party. The young man picked up the gun and shot him.
And Adon saw his brother.
He heard the shot, the screaming, and then he saw my other son dead. And I think that just triggered everything.
The more serious the case, the longer the delays, the more likely that you're going to find yourself in this loop, in a kind of a dark Groundhog Day, experiencing it again, and then again, and then again.
We've created an investigative docuseries along with videos on solutions surrounding this topic and a mental health resource page online to accompany this podcast season. Just go to lockedinlimbo.com. Catalyst is reported, produced, and edited by me, Josh Hinkle, along with David Barrere, Arzo Dost, and Chris Nelson. Digital support for this episode comes from Dax Dobbs, Stephanie Dockery, Rachel Garza, Eric Henriksen, Eric Leffenfeld, Matt Mitchell, Martin Sanchez, Robert Sims, and Kate Winkle. KXAN's news director is Chad Cross, and its vice president and general manager is Eric Glassberg.